Ja, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft, heute mit einer Sendung, und zwar spreche ich mit Paula Piwi. Sie ist gerade die Künstlerin, die im Portikus die Ausstellung It's a Cocktail Party arrangiert hat. Und zwar in dieser Ausstellung sind verschiedene Flüssigkeiten zu sehen, wie zum Beispiel Tinte, Glycerin, Waldmeister, Gesichtstonic, Milch, Espresso, Rotwein, Wasser und Olivenöl, die durch bestimmte Pumpen mit einer enormen Wucht in große Bottiche befördert werden. Und über diese Installation sprechen wir und auch über weitere Arbeiten von Paula Piwi, die auf eine sehr elegante Weise mit Realität spielt. Und diese in Mailand geborene Künstlerin lebt jetzt in Alaska, und wir werden dann auch ihre Projekte, die sie in Alaska macht, versuchen zu besprechen, indem wir auch das durch musikalisch dann untermalen. Was wir gerade gehört haben, das ist Billie Holiday, und zwar Remixed and Reimagined von What's the name? Featuring remixes by DJ Logic, Tony Humphries, Nicodemus and Zepp and more. Okay, und jetzt hören wir schon mal rein in das Interview.
Yeah, you started to. Now the question would be when you started to think about being an artist, because you studied something else. Mm-hmm. So how does this came up to work more in other contexts, like the art world, with your specific way of dealing with reality?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was studying completely different things. I was studying engineering, and at the same time I was an aerobic teacher to support myself.
Yeah.
Because I went to high school in Canada.
Yeah.
So every student in Canada had a job and supported himself, so it was natural for me to have a very fun job.
Yeah.
And to study and to be completely independent very early, which is unusual in Italy. So I had like a very fulfilling life, and I never encountered art before. But then in 94, a series of coincidences, I saw the comic strips of Andrea Pazienza, which are art, and that was striking for me. And in the same time, I saw the drawings of Egon Schiele, mm-hmm. and really saw the art in them. And so this was a total revelation, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was very curious and active, and I thought I will go to art academy just to, you know,
to see what's going on there.
to learn a little bit better to draw. I was drawing for fun or copying these comic strips, or I was a little bit bored with engineering.
Mm.
So slowly I decided after 5 years to leave it.
Mm.
It was a very difficult decision. It's very difficult to take decisions like that in life. Leave
yeah.
a story that was also very interesting and very good for me.
Yeah.
But it was not a passion.
Mm.
So I left engineering and I just went to the art academy for curiosity, fun, without even knowing what I was going into it.
I
didn't know what I was going into. I was just curious.
So, have you been to Halifax?
In Canada, I was in Ottawa.
Oh.
But that was high school.
Yeah.
This was happening in Milan. And then since I thought, okay, in a couple of months I'm going to be in the art academy in a newsstand, I thought I should read something about art. So I picked one of those publications, the thin ones. They have one on every artist or movement. And I picked the Dada one. And I completely fell in love with it. and then I was rejected in the art academy exam. And then I was called back a couple of weeks later. They told me, no, we enlarged the numbers, you're in. And this happened just before paying like one of those huge fees in the private academies, because when I was rejected in the public academy, I thought, oh, well, I'll try the private one.
Yeah.
And just the day before paying the fee, they called me from the public academy. And so I went to the public academy.
In Milan.
Yeah. And I was just wandering through classes and met Alberto Garutti, mm-hmm. who teaches contemporary art very well, and just went to his classes for 3 years, every day. And that was passion. And
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. So, but from your engineering background, is there something that you can use now for your artworks?
Well, I cannot use the quantum mechanics because I totally forgot it. Or I cannot use those other things. I don't even remember the names.
Mm-hmm.
Engineering in Italy is really hard, so it teaches you a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I like hard schools. I think everybody should go to a very hard school. I don't think schools that are easy are good for mature people. I don't know. But yes, engineering was great. I also liked it a lot, but I would never feel happy there.
Mm. Okay. And to come back to your artworks, when you were invited to the Venice Biennale, you had this donkey project. So how was this arranged with the donkey? Was it a real donkey on a boat?
In those years I was living in a small island called Alicudi,
yeah.
near Sicily, and I was taking these photos. And the donkey was a local donkey, and the boat was a local boat. There are no cars on that island because there are only steps. So donkeys are the transportation system for food, suitcases, whatever is small enough to go on a donkey goes on a donkey. The bigger things are carried by hand by people because there are only steps.
Yeah.
There are no cars. The only road is maybe 200 meters long. And so the photos came out and I had them ready to show when I was invited by Bonami to be in the biennial. And I had the idea of putting that photo on a huge billboard.
Yeah.
And I proposed it to him and he liked it and it happened.
So you didn't bring this donkey to Venice?
No, only the billboard. Yes.
Ah, yeah. It was not.
Yeah, the
like,
photo was done in Alicudi.
Boat transportation to Frankfurt with boats from different cities. So it was not the idea of transportation of the donkeys.
No. And the photo was done by Hugo Glendinning.
Mm-hmm.
I very rarely use my own shots in my work.
Yeah.
Most of the time, I call a photographer. And most of the time it's Hugo Glendinning.
Mm-hmm. To do that, yeah. And
sometimes also Attilio Maranzano. But
that is okay. And I have another question about the zebra, because I was asked if that zebra was really made somewhere in the snow on the Alps, or?
Yes, it was made in the mountains called Gran Sasso that are near Rome.
Yeah.
Nobody knows that there are these quite tall mountains, more than 2,000 meters.
Okay.
Basically, east of Rome. And it's a wonderful place because the tourism there, it's almost non-existent. So it's a very natural and empty landscape, so it was perfect for me to find this to bring this place and to bring these zebras that were from Rome. They were
from the zoo,
from the circus. They were trained animals.
Aye.
The animals in the zoo are not trained, so you cannot move them.
To train zebras.
Well, I think they have a little bit of a itchy character, but
But
they were trained. They had their names were Del Piero and Baggio. So the whole day it was like calling, Del Piero, come back, Baggio, come back. Because we let them free. But one of them was older and not really running around. And the other one was younger and running around like a free animal, but it would always come back to the older one. So the first day the trainers, there were 12 people who came to take care of them.
Yeah.
The first day they really kept them under control inside those electric fences that you can put up, and you don't even have to switch them on because the animals know them and they would not jump out of them. But the situation was so calm, and there was nobody else around, and this was a huge plain surrounded by mountains. So the second day they decided to let them free, and we were following them.
Yeah.
Because they noticed that the older one would never run away more than 100 meters, and so it was a very beautiful day of basically running around with zebras in this huge plain. And the photos came in the second day.
Yeah. And
and Hugo Glendinning was taking the photos again.
Okay. And because I saw another image where you used a leopard, I think?
Yes.
Walking through cups.
Yeah.
So why are you using always animals? Or not always, but sometimes animals.
I don't know.
For your work, has this something to do to bring different realities together? Like
my
the
feeling
and the more unrecognized world of the animals, which are not
well, my feeling is that I just have ideas about things that fascinate me, like in this case liquids or a leopard or cappuccino cups, or it's just things, or an airplane upside down. It's just things that I like in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the same way I used a pizza, mm-hmm. in a huge pizza, then I used a leopard, and then I don't know, something else that completely different.
Yeah.
Pearls or cookies or a truck.
Yeah.
Or the shape of the ass in other photos, or so on.
Mm-hmm. But it's important for you to have more complicated structure in building or in realizing some art works.
Well, it looks like I'm not scared of the complicated realizations, so I do whatever I can do, and there are some ideas that are not doable and I don't do them. I go as far as I can.
Yeah. And I don't know, you had before you came here, you had this opening in Basel.
Mm-hmm.
That was more
almost a year ago now.
Ah, yeah, this was last year, so then I mixed it up somehow. But it was more retrospective of your...
It was... the show was occupying entirely the Kunsthalle Basel. So there were some new works and some old works.
Yeah.
The largest new work was the performance with the leopard. The title was One Cup of Cappuccino, Then I Go. The title of the whole show was It Just Keeps Getting Better.
Yeah.
And then there were new sculptures, and then there were other new sculptures. So it was a mixture of some older works and some new works, maybe 50% and 50%.
Yeah. So how was this arranged with the leopards that he took one cappuccino?
What do you mean, how was arranged?
Where did you get this leopard?
Oh, I got it from a tamer, from a magician who works with the leopard.
From a what?
A magician.
Okay.
Like a magician person.
Yeah.
Who also works with the leopard.
Mm-hmm.
And I arranged the work over two rooms.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed making a work over two rooms, because these two rooms had two connecting doors.
Mm-hmm.
So I could build an enormous cage,
mm-hmm.
really big cage, for a leopard over the two rooms using one of the doors. And the viewers could use outside the cage the other door and also have both the rooms. And this was incredible, because the leopard was going freely in one or the other room, but when you were in the opposite room where the leopard was not there, that was also a very interesting feeling of knowing that there was a leopard, but you couldn't have visual contact with the animal, and that was a very strong feeling too, because you knew that there was a leopard in the next room, but you couldn't see him. It was scary too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So and then it was made a photograph, I guess.
Yes.
And you had then the empty installation for a few of this.
For the rest of the show, yes, the leftover, the cage and the 3,000 cappuccino cups, all messed up by the leopard running around, and there was a leopard house, and there was a ground in some areas on the floor.
Yeah. Okay. And come now to the cocktail party here. How did you decide to use the different fluids for that show? What is the meaning of these?
I wanted a variety of fluids from our everyday life. So yes. Some are food and some are like the nice food.
Mm-hmm.
Red wine, olive oil, and milk and espresso, and then I had water, of course, and then I had facial tonic, and then I have glycerin, which is I wanted one chemical liquid, and glycerin is a chemical liquid that is contained in food, so I was sure that is not poisonous or dangerous for us, because it's used in food and soap products, and then I had ink, because of course I wanted the ink. And I was just thinking like of a big variety of liquids.
And the woodruff syrup?
Yeah, that came last minute to replace, there was supposed to be liquid soap, but it would make too much foam. And then it was supposed to be strawberry yogurt, but it would make too much foam too, so then I put, I asked what's a typical local nice liquid, and somebody told me.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. We are using this sometimes in beer.
Yeah.
So you, this would be possible, but beer is difficult as well.
And well, I had the wine. I didn't want to have
another
two of the same.
Okay.
Just like trying to have a variety of colors, of the nature of the liquid and of the thickness of the liquid.
Yeah.
Just like a variety. If I had more machines, I would have more. If I had less, I would have less.
Yeah.
But just like a variety of simple things.
And the machine oil was not possible because instead of olive oil...
This is olive oil, yes.
Yeah. But I heard that you first wanted to have machine oil.
Oh, well, yeah. Having the possibility to stay away from poisonous things or possibly poisonous things to breathe, you know. Because it creates a big atmosphere of these liquids. I just stayed away from flammable or poisonous liquids.
Yeah.
Having the possibility to have like olive oil in, for sure, if you breathe it or get splashed with it, it could be good for your hair or skin anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, when we stand here, we can see here this form from these plants. Yeah. And so you came here and you just found the way of constructing it with the pumps and for the space as well.
I came here and I had the idea of the falling liquids, and then I consulted with a technical person. How can we make this falling liquid in this height and in this diameter? And then, like, the simplest machine that does this is this.
And why is it important for you that the liquids are falling down, and why do they have to fall down at this high pressure and how?
I don't want to myself. I don't want to investigate that. When I turn on the tap water, that flow of water falling like a cylinder, it's a beautiful thing to watch. So,
yeah.
And the cycle is also a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I really like that it's falling down with such a pressure. Without it, it wouldn't have such a...
And waterfalls are always magical places in nature.
Yeah.
So, in the end, these become like a huge waterfall.
Yeah, that's right. And the noise is the same.
The noise is the same, yes.
Yeah, so there are different aspects of it.
Do you have the time just to make sure I can relax or...
Ja, Paula Piwi ist letzte Woche wieder zurück nach Alaska. Darüber sprechen wir jetzt noch und über die Culture Brothers, die Gruppe, die sie in Alaska unterstützt.
Today you are going back to Alaska, and what is important for you to stay in a country like Alaska? Is it this?
It's my home.
Close up to nature.
It's my home. I can't wait to go home.
Because you grew up in Canada.
No, that was just a couple of years in high school, and it was in a big city anyway. I mean, medium-sized city anyway. I just love Alaska. I love it. It's like an island.
Yeah.
Away and with its own rules and with this overwhelming nature constantly around me.
Yeah. Yeah, in your lecture you were talking about Alaska. So, but I missed it, so that's the question. Has this some kind of importance for being closer to nature, not only being at home?
I like places that are in themselves like a cinema.
Yeah.
Watching a movie in the cinema. Some visitors.
What's that?
So bekommt man doch noch einen visuellen, einen akustischen Eindruck der Installation im Portikus, die noch bis zum 9. März dort zu sehen ist. Ja, im Hintergrund noch Billie Holiday. Und jetzt wechseln wir gleich zu den Culture Brothers und Paula P.
In Alaska is music. And I actively participate in the music world by being a manager of a band. The name of the band is Culture Brothers. And it's a wonderful mixture of Tibetan music, Yupik music and American music. And Yupik is one of the Native American tribes of Alaska. And Carol Wasilie, who is the Yupik member of the band, he uses his culture in music, his tradition in music, in a very wonderful way, as he doesn't try to mix it with a modern way of making music, and at the same time, he doesn't use it as something from the past, but he uses it in a very lively, alive way. Yeah. The band is Karma, who is Tibetan, and he learned to play music when he was raised as a monk in a Buddhist monastery in Nepal. So his music is very intense and communicative too, coming from this background. And for the last CD, the title is Learn How to Respect, they invited Daniel L'Esperance, a very good guitar player from New Mexico in the United States. So it's a mixture of all these three cultures, and that's why it's called Culture Brothers. And the website is www.culturebrothers.com, where you can listen to some sounds.
And so you...
Ja, das sind die Culture Brothers.
Traditional instruments as well. It's a
yes, they use the Yupik drum, which is a round, flat, large drum, handheld and played with a stick. It can have a transparent seal skin on the drum, or it could have a similar industrial fabric. Mm. And they use flute, and they use guitar, and gong, and djembe, the wood drum from Africa, and they use keyboard, electronic keyboard, and these are the instruments, and shakers, and these are and vocals.
Yeah, and... if there are minimal changes through global warming for the Yupiks, do you have any ideas to work as an artist about the situation? Maybe with an ice field, for example? Maybe you have to think about
Well, I this winter in Anchorage there is very much less snow than usual. So I don't know. I didn't work yet with global warming, and I have no idea if it will happen or not.
Okay. And with the beer? To work with the beer?
With the bear?
Yeah.
The animal, the bear?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I made two sculptures. One is called What's My Name? And the other one is called Life is Great. And they are real size polar bears, which is a very big size, about 3 meters tall when they're standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And they are made of fake materials, so they're not taxidermy bears, but they look like a real polar bear that for some reason is covered in yellow feathers rather than in the white fur.
Okay. But to work with a normal polar bear?
Well, I hope not. I hope I never have an idea with the bears. But also, it depends. Maybe I'll do some photos with them roaming in the distance. I have no desire to be in close contact.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very scary situation. There are many, many bears in Alaska, and you always have to be careful. And it's a very strong feeling of danger every time you, even you are in the outskirts of the city, or every time you are anywhere in nature, you have to always think about it and be careful. Because they are very powerful animals. Most of the time they just walk away when they smell you, but it's a very, very strong fear that you feel all the time.
Yeah, thank you.
Ja, hier hören wir noch Culture Brothers. mit Murray Gaylord vom aus Südafrika, der gerade an der Städelschule auch Kunst studiert. Und weil heute auch wieder Rundgang ist in der Städelschule und man bis Sonntag dort von 10 bis 20 Uhr jeweils sich Arbeiten von 150 Studenten in dem Sinne anschauen kann, dachte ich, spiele ich auch noch Auszüge aus einem Interview mit Murray, der ja erstmal davon erzählt, wie er in Südafrika aufgewachsen ist.
Well, my mother's father was British, so he lived in England, but then he moved to South Africa, so it's from three generations ago, okay, and I come from a very English background, although my father apparently, I mean, I'm not sure, but he comes more from the Afrikaans background, although he is an English native speaker, yeah. Yeah, I think my grandparents moved to the East Coast before my mother was born.
And your parents, how did they make their living when you grew up?
My father worked as a computer technician. And my mother was a bookkeeper.
Bookkeeper?
Buchhalter.
Okay.
Or an accountant. I don't know if my mother's really an accountant, but she kept books. Sounds a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? A bookkeeper. But yeah, a bookkeeper. I think what's interesting
for me,
I think as an artist from South Africa though, is that only since I've moved to Europe am I able to really see South Africa clearly. Because, you know, I grew up in a police state. I mean, it was a police state, and all of the media images and exposure that you had in Europe, somehow we didn't have it all. I mean, we didn't have strong censorship. I mean, a lot of it was shown, but like, I don't know how they did it. I was too young to even think about it, yeah. But everything was sort of like kept quite low tone, you know, like all of the awful details of the policemen going in with their dogs into townships. This was not given the same kind of media coverage in South Africa as it was internationally. And so I grew up with a real kind of knowing that this injustice is wrong, but not exactly knowing how bad it was. Do you know what I mean? And only since obviously when I studied in South Africa, I studied sociology at the University of Cape Town, and through that, of course, I mean, I was involved in lots of protests and quite a lot of political action at that point. 1992. It was just before the first democratic elections. It was a fascinating time because when I started at university, I think it was the first year or maybe the second year that non-whites could apply to study at universities in the country. And it was very interesting how things...
And how were the contacts and how was it? I mean...
It was hard, you know.
It
was hard for everybody because I think if you had to sit at the bottom of the stairs, yeah, of like, it's like a massive like monument by the university, all these big stairs where all the students sit. If you had to sit at the bottom of it and look up at the people eating lunch, you still would really only see non-whites with each other and whites with each other. The separation is probably today even quite strong, and at that time it had nothing to do with racism, I think it had more to do with a kind of an ethnocentrism. You know, this kind of idea that my culture is simply too different to yours, so we cannot come together. And this was really hard because, you know, it is just so different. It's like bringing two worlds together suddenly. And of course it didn't mix perfectly in the beginning. I'm sure it's much better now than it was, because of course we are all growing up together now in the country. But when I was a boy, the African man was the man who cleaned your garden and mowed your lawn, and there was no other definition of the African man. Can you understand? Do you know what I mean? And then everyone studying together, and of course it's very difficult for these groups to penetrate each other. They did, but not as much as I thought they would. I mean, I was quite involved, of course, because, you know, I was part of a few organizations, sort of township helping organizations for abused children, and like the Gay Liberation Front kind of thing. You know, I used to do stuff with that. So there was a lot of, for me, there was a lot of interaction. But yeah, I think it's such a strong, a hard wound. You know, really, such a really terrible history that I think it will take a lot longer than everybody thought.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes time. So when did something like...
Am I talking too much?
No. When did something like friendship start? Or when did you observe that you started friendships with some of the
Africans? Yeah. Interestingly enough, though, it was more a question of, in terms of who your non-white friends were, was more a question of, I think, for me, sexual identity. So if a black man was gay, I would automatically be friends with him because he would automatically belong to my in-group, as it is in sociological circles. I mean, you know, if you have something in common, you are like a little circle. And so, of course, I had black friends who were gay. Or, you know, my sister, for example, long before the first democratic elections, like in the 80s, she had a girlfriend in the street, a little black girl, and she was the daughter of diplomats. And so it really wasn't a question of race, it was a question of socioeconomic status. So if some...
The others were black?
Yeah. They were the only black family in our street, actually, when I was young. My sister's 4 years younger than I am, so she was really young, actually, when these two girls became friends. But the children of African diplomats were allowed to go to white schools when they were young. They just felt terribly out. I mean, it was... I remember when I was at school, I think we had about 2,000 people in my school, and I think about 5 of them were non-whites, and I don't think they ever spoke to any... I think they were really like their own little clique. I cannot remember ever seeing them with any white children.
And you were not interested in talking to them or becoming...
I wouldn't say I wasn't interested. I just didn't... I felt like there was no access to it, because, you know, the African way of life was just kept so, like, foreign for white people. It was so divided and separated that it was like another world. It's very hard to put into words. I'm finding it difficult to sort of, you know, because I didn't consciously not want to have black friends. It just was like, we are us and they are they. You know, when I was young, and when you're young, you don't question things like this so much.
Yeah. And your family, have they had a mate?
Yeah.
And how was your relationship?
Very good. I mean, I must say, on that level, from a European perspective, that's really strange, I think, that all the white people have maids. It is, of course, strange, and the work is not very expensive. I mean, the wages were relatively low. But my parents, I have to say, really looked after our maid very well. I mean, we had a little cottage on the property, and she could live there with her family, you know, like... could eat from my mother's fridge, you know, that kind of thing. There were no, like, rules, kind of like, you don't get anything but your mummy. I mean, she was really quite well looked after, I have to say. And you know, I think that...
But it was limited, so part
yeah.
of the situation.
Yeah, sure.
So the kids from there, they had no chance to go to school?
No, they had to go to a farm school. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's only for me to understand better how it was organized, because to organize a separation, it's how is it functioning?
I mean, I personally think that, well, I mean, maybe this is naive to say this, but having a maid in a country that suffered under an apartheid government was a little bit like a very informal way of keeping the unemployment from escalating. You know, because at the end of the day, I mean, God, don't get me wrong. Yeah, I mean, it would have been better without the apartheid. But the reality is that there was the apartheid. That is simply the reality. And from that point, I suppose that is the best thing a white person could do. Do you know what I mean? It's to offer somebody a job who doesn't have a job,
yeah.
even though it wasn't the highest paid job.
But they were not able to apply to a job market if they have no education. So.
Well, exactly. I mean, they were totally kept from everything else, so they had to only do those jobs, yes.
So now, if it's now possible for everybody to...
Now it's different, of course.
...apply to education, then they have the chance to get another job.
Yeah.
Not only one kind of job.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's difficult. And could you remember the time when you started to think about as being an artist or as thinking as an artist? Or when have you started to... No, it has probably more to do with this, how you are developing your...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize what I was doing was artistic. I mean, I started in writing. I've always been somebody who writes. I wrote lots of poetry. That's the first creative stuff I ever really did, actually. I used to go on walks in the early 90s. I used to go for like 4 days, just wake up in the middle of the night and then go for a walk, you know, out into the... Yeah, hitchhike out of the town, and I did it a few times really. And then I used to write poetry about my experiences, like the homeless people I would meet. I mean, I gave like one man on the street everything I had, you know, a jacket, everything. And then I slept on a wine farm in amongst the grapes for the workers. I really immersed myself in the culture as much as I could, because I knew, of course, that there were these... This was really at the time, though, when the apartheid was thrown over, yeah? It was like 93, when I was, like, walking. Sounds ridiculous, but, yeah, I was walking. Walking and writing. Walking and writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, sentence for 4 days, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this coupled with my study of sociology and philosophy... I don't think that I would. Yeah, it's very interesting because when I finished my study of sociology, I then went. I went actually with my partner to a course called Malen für Unbegabte. And it's bizarre because I painted a little bit here, there, and I realized that I didn't know why, but I had to be an artist. I wanted to have this definition. I wanted to be able to say, hello, I'm an artist. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really bizarre, but it became my dream. And I didn't realize, actually, that painting doesn't make you an artist. I was already doing artistic things, and I was thinking artistically, and I was thinking about concepts and social injustices. And that's
ja, also das vollständige Interview kann man sich dann auch auf der Webseite fehe.org anhören, weil jetzt sind wir doch am Ende der Sendung. Und genau dieses Jonglieren zwischen dem, ist man ein Künstler, was macht man da eigentlich, wie kann man eigentlich unauffällig bleiben und so weiter, das kann man heute alles in der Städelschule sehen während des Rundgangs. Okay, Dürerstraße 11. Bis dann, ciao. Am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft. Ich bedanke mich bei Mary Gaylord und bei Paula Peavy für die Gespräche. Bis dann, ciao.